Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Why don't we give you a chance?
Yeah, we'd love that.
Well, let's start with something simple. Very How about simple. That?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right, let's do it.
Okay.
Then. Okay.
This is the Extra Hot Gray Podcast, episode 346 for the week of March 15th, 2021. I am first grocer David T. Cole, and I'm here with business casual B, Sarah D. Bunting.
Have you ever even had a job?
Potato publicist Tara Ariano.
Why do potatoes need a publicist?
And produce purveyor Allison Herman.
Flavor is life.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us at long last, her first scheduled appearance was scuttled by jury duty. Her second scheduled appearance was scuttled by the snowpocalypse. She's here now, thank God. Allison Herman from The Ringer. Hello!
Hello!
Allison!
Hello! It's such a relief to be here for so many reasons.
Finally happy.
Welcome! Yay! We are here to talk about the new Netflix show, Waffles and Mochi, which comes to us from Barack and Michelle Obama's production company, but specifically from former Drunk History creator Jeremy Connor, among others. The breakdown is this. In the land of frozen food, Waffles, the child of a waffle and a Yeti, and Mochi, a strawberry Mochi, watch Julia Child on TV and dream of being chefs, but all Waffles can make is ice cubes. One day they stow away in a delivery truck and end up in a supermarket in a temperate part of what seems to be the U.S. with a garden on the roof tended by the owner, Mrs. Obama. In each episode, she gives them a task in the store that helps them learn about fresh food, all of which is new to them since, you know, they did not have that where they are from. 10 episodes have dropped this week. We may talk about events from any of them, but like, it is a show for children with puppets. I think we can all be reasonable and agree. Spoiler rules do not apply. Let us quickly go around the circle and just let our listeners know if we think they should watch this show, perhaps with or without their children. Allison, should our listeners watch Waffles and Mochi?
Well, I am not a parent, and I'm obviously not a child, so I'm not really well-equipped to testify to its effectiveness as actual children's TV, teaching kids how to expand their appetite. I will say it is definitely worth watching because it is so weird to see a former First Lady of the United States serve as a children's TV host on a streaming service.
Okay. Sarah?
No. I mean, look, it's a kid's show. Everything Allison just said applies. With that said, I used to share a domicile with children. I have watched way more annoying and pointedly kidsy stuff than this. It's like on a scale of 1 to Caillou, it's like a 1.5. But yeah, no.
Okay.
It's cute, but no.
Dave?
I think if you have kids, this is a show that is better than most to be stuck watching them with. I think it is cute. Yep. I don't really know if I need to watch every single episode because, you know, I am not a kid, but I did enjoy it. I will say there is actually a big spoiler in episode 1 about tomatoes. Are they a vegetable? Are they a fruit? Stay tuned. What did you think, Tara?
I mean, I think you all know how I feel about its vegetable agenda, but I did think it was cute. I watched more of it than I expected to. I think parents would enjoy watching this with their kids, and I certainly have a lot to say about Mochi, starting with, I would die for him. So
yes.
Let's get into it.
And his accessories.
Oh, absolutely. My God, yes. We'll talk more about him for sure. So let's get into it into more nitty-gritty. Allison, we certainly can get to the larger Obama cultural project of it all in due time, but may we start with how adorable it is, because as I wrote last night on Instagram in a caption under a photo of Mochi, would die for him. After a point, all my notes just became about him and how much I loved him, like his tiny Same. Apron badge. I can't. Mochi in a space yes, helmet.
Literally what my notes said as well.
I mean, bracket adorable squealing and bracket is the caption yes. for every utterance he makes.
Yeah. I turned on the captions at one point because Dave had gone to sleep, and seeing meeps in awe and meeps excitedly was like what I needed. By the time I got to Mochi and his reading glasses, I was like, okay, Mochi is my friend. So what did you think of the cuteness of the show?
I mean, it's adorable, and it's also such an insane grab bag of so many different genres and topics, which mm-hmm. I'm sure is meant to keep the attention of kids. And also, I was doing some Googling, and the co-creator, Erica Thormelin, has basically, like, she produced a pilot for the New York TV Festival in, like, 2006 called Waffles and Mincemeat, or Mouse Meat, which, Mochi, big improvement there.
Yeah.
But... point being, like, she's clearly been sitting on this concept in some form for a really, really long time. Mm-hmm. And I think you can almost see that in just, like, how much stuff there is. Like, there's the travel segments, there's the yeah. animation segments, there are the songs, there are the lessons, there's the anything, like, you name the type of segment you might see on a food or a kids show, and it is in here. So there's just so much stuff in it that by the time you're maybe exhausted by one thing, it's on to the next thing.
Yeah. Sarah. The first episode targets you directly by being about tomatoes. How did you feel they did documenting a fruit so close to your heart?
I think it, yeah, it literally is pretty close to my heart. Mm-hmm. I have a tattoo of a tomato on my bicep, for those of you that forgot that information. I didn't find any lies in the episode. I'm a little sorry that they skipped over the fact that according to Supreme Court ruling from the 1920s, it is legally a vegetable, but botanically a fruit. But now you know, and you don't have to, the show doesn't have to get into that or do a follow up. It's sort of ironic to me that this show that is all about like trying to pull kids more towards like less processed and prepared foods is going to end up for adults being this Baby Yoda merch situation where I, for one, will buy a Mochi and all of his little accessories, his helmet, his apron, all the badges that go on it.
Yep.
It is someone's job to make Mochi gear for the show, and that it's not one of our jobs is really a little bit heartbreaking, frankly. Call us. I do have a full sewing kit. But yeah, I mean, it is really cute, and it's like, it's definitely a kid's show in that like performatively explainy way, but I don't think it's, I've seen so much worse again. Mm. Like I'm a veteran of Pinwheel from growing up, and this is not nearly as bad. I thought Mrs. Obama was quite good. Unsurprisingly, I think she was pretty natural. But yeah, I don't think this is necessary for adults, but I am very interested to see how this property generally handles its merchandising opportunities, given what it's trying to do as a show.
Right. Dave, did you learn anything from your experience with the show?
What didn't I learn? I'm so dumb. What I thought was this show would be great if I had some kids. I had to stick in front of some TV, and I didn't want to stick them in front of, you know, Mattel's Chocobot Power Hour and something that was a little less commercial. I thought that it had so many segments, and it kind of felt to me like the way I would watch Sesame Street sometimes when I was a kid, in that totally. I was there for the Muppets and then tuning out for things that weren't the Muppets because by comparison, they were never as good. There were always these one-offs that you weren't familiar with and attached to as a kid. So if I was watching this as a kid, I would be all about everything that had to do with Waffles and Mochi. And then like when it came time for the singing tomato, I would tune out because it seemed like that was now a different show.
Right.
Maybe I had a better attention span than producers give kids credit for these days. I always was bummed out when I was a kid watching, you know, kind of the variety style kids shows that change gears so much, at least to a kid's eye. Like that singing tomato bit, I would have been like, wandering around the house, getting into trouble during that. And then like the only one of those type of things that held my attention was the Pointer Sisters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 pinball short. And only because that was about pinball and I was like video game and video game adjacent obsessed as a kid. So,
well, speaking of the different segments, I mean, I think we all know in the abstract, these streaming services have all our money, but it's still always a little surprising to me when you see it on the screen. Those puppets get around. Allison, talk about the travel segments. What? How do you think they did? Were they effective as far as you felt?
I mean, they were effective in that it made me miss the rest of the world even more than I currently do in my house. And also, I mean, the budget for me came through in the travel budget, but also in the quality of guest stars. Like, Netflix does this thing where, you know, they're the everything network, but they've really started pushing like the kind of internal brand synergy. So you get like Tan France, Samin Nosrat, multiple guest chefs who were also featured on Chef's Table. And they're very, you know, we're like probably 6 months away from like an Ugly Delicious times Waffles and Mochi crossover episode. So you really felt like Netflix was putting its full firepower, but then you also get parts where I guess they somehow took a puppet to like the salt flats of Bolivia or Peru or whichever part of Central America they were in. And, you know, Japan and Savannah. And then like when you get really late in the series, you start to see that they double up. So they filmed the Michael Twitty interview. He's a food historian in The Gray, which is the restaurant owned by Mashama Bailey, who's one of the Chef's Table alumni who comes in with the corn episode to teach Waffles and Mochi how to make cornmeal. So it's both like very, very, very broad and also clearly like circular and in dialogue with both itself and other Netflix shows.
Yeah, that's true. The Tan France potato makeover segment was kind of a stretch, but also worked on me. I enjoyed it very much. Putting a tuxedo on a potato. I mean, I'm not made of stone. So I read the review on The Ringer by Allison's colleague, Justin Charity, and on Vanity Fair by past and future guest Sonia Soraya, both of which note, as you kind of have to, this is not a traditional post-presidency job. And Charity's take is maybe that's for the best, given what happened with the Clinton Global Initiative. Sonia's kind of pre-exhausted by where this is going to end up in the idiot culture wars. And it does seem unlikely that right-wingers are going to start buying produce to set it on fire in protest. But given, I mean, Sonia knows how stiff Michelle Obama seems. I'm surprised to hear Sarah say she thought she was good on camera because I thought she was stiff as well. I mean, even playing this version of herself, like I thought maybe she should have tried to sidestep controversy by not being in it. I don't know. Allison, what did you think about that?
I mean, I don't even know how wide ranging of a political discussion we want to get into on a TV show. But of course, it's inevitable because that's Michelle Obama. And, you know, Willa Paskin wrote a really great piece a few weeks ago about kind of the anxiety of politics and culture merging even further. That was sort of pegged to this and the Barack Obama Springsteen podcast. But I think for me, the fact that the Obamas specifically chose to go into like producing content for streaming services really feeds into this like larger exhaustion I feel like a lot of left-leaning people have with them, which is, you know, that their legacy basically, it is cultural and it is not so much in the like material impacts of their administration. And it just feels like them completely embracing that in the way that you see, you know, that those waves of Twitter exhaustion whenever Barack posts the like, here's all the albums I like this year list with an infographic. But I think with Michelle Obama, both like obviously she had the softer role to begin with and, you know, children's nutrition and obesity was like her main cause in office. So I thought this was maybe a little more organic than other projects they've taken on, including for Netflix.
Organic. I see what you mean.
I was thinking it.
If she wasn't in front of the camera, we wouldn't be having this segment on the show right now. This would just be another children's show on some streaming network. So, you know, that part of it, it's sort of like Steph Curry having to come on Holy Moly to juice up its profile so that it can get on ABC and they can do the promos and it can become that four quadrant show, right? It's sort of like that, except somehow it's like an even bigger personality. It's the former first lady. So without that, I mean, it makes sense for them, right? This is the way that we're doing free press for it. Everybody's doing free press. Everybody's talking about it because it's this new thing.
Yeah.
otherwise, it's just this cute show, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I did, given that food, like everything, is political, I did think it was interesting, the choices they made and how they framed them for a young audience. Like, for example, you mentioned Michael Twitty, Allison, in the rice episode when he's telling the story of how his ancestors were brought to the U.S. from Sierra Leone to grow rice by force. I mean, he uses the word enslavement and then teaches Waffles and Mochi a work song. Like, he's not, he does not... Pardon the pun. I mean, he doesn't sugarcoat it. Right. Like he's, you know, he says it like it is. And I thought that was an interesting choice. And it really spoke to the values behind the show.
Yeah, there are all these little moments like that. Like I noticed they have the Chef Pretty Mystery from Oakland on in a later episode. And they just kind of effortlessly use, you know, non-binary pronouns when it comes to their presence on the show. And, you know, they include all these, you know, I actually really like this part. They include like interviews with kids from all over the world, and they're all speaking in different languages. And it's just a very subtle, but like very clearly furthering the multicultural. I can understand basically why Sonia thought this would become an object of culture wars. I don't think that's wrong.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's going to broaden kids' palates. That seems like a bigger job than any TV show.
What would be the counter protest, though? Like, feed your kids potato chips from the age of two, and that's it. No vegetables are good food for you, kid.
Yeah.
This is the Red House.
I mean, I don't think we can come up with anything stupider than Freedom Fries, and that was a real thing that happened in this country, so never underestimate.
Yeah.
True.
That's a very good point. It is time to go around the dial. Our first stop is Tara.
Well, I'm going to do my lowbrow pick first. Step Up High Water. They made a TV show out of Step Up in 2018. The reason you probably did not know that this existed for two seasons is that it was on YouTube Red. But now that that is not a platform that is trying to exist anymore, it's been picked up for another season on Stars, and Stars has started airing the old episodes now. So basically it's the same trajectory that Cobra Kai followed, except potentially not as successful because fewer people have Stars than have Netflix. But anyway, the story is, it's a Step Up story. There is a couple of kids who want to dance, the twins Tal, who is a boy, and Janelle. And to switch it up, the boy is the ballet dancer and the girl is into hip hop and cheer. I know. Their parent is taken out of the picture. She's a drug user who relapses and she goes to prison. So they move from Ohio to Atlanta to live with their uncle Al. And there's a weird progressive, like interdisciplinary arts school there called High Water that was started by a hometown pop star named Sage Odom. He's played by Neo. And Janelle really wants to go. Uncle Al's dubious about it because you have to get your high school diploma on your own outside of whatever you do at the school. Just like, how is this a school? Whatever. So she sneaks into audition. Tal covers for her while getting horribly bullied at the regular high school that he attends. But by the end of the second episode, he's been essentially chased by his antagonist into her audition and just announces they have to let him audition too. It's a matter of life and death. Of course, he nails the audition and then... I won't spoil it, but it's actually hilarious how much it follows the beats of a teen dance movie, starting with the parent is gone trope, although usually they are dead. And now I have to go to an unfamiliar city and live with a relative I barely know, and on through the cool people in my new town think I'm a fake tight ass, and oh no, the place where we dance is in financial trouble. The story parts are, as always, pretty boring, but the late Naya Rivera is in it as the director of the school. It's nice to see her. I've only watched the first two episodes that are up on Stars. She's already gotten to sing a little, so I hope there'll be more of that. The dance numbers are excellent, really well staged. That's obviously what you're here for, so I would say watch it like you watch 911. Pay attention to the action. Otherwise, look at your phone because the in-between parts don't matter. And then my highbrow is Kid 90. I talked about the Punky Brewster revival on Peacock a couple weeks ago. Soleil Moon Frye is the actor who played her, of course. She's back this week with a documentary on Hulu called Kid 90, which she directed. And when she was a teenager and young adult, she had video cameras. She used them to film herself and her friends, apparently, all the time. And apparently she was friends with every kid in show business who was, like, anywhere near her age. She gets contemporary on-camera interviews with... Mark Paul Gosselaar, David Arquette, Stephen Dorff, Baltazar Getty, Heather McComb, James Vanderbeek's first wife, and Brian Austin Green. But we also see footage or photos of her with Jenny Lewis, Sarah Gilbert, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jonathan Brandis, Mark Wahlberg, Jared Leto, Johnny Depp, Edward Furlong, Danica McKellar, Michael Rapaport, blah, 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 like just tons of people. Truly, based on this, you would think she really knew everybody. So there's probably a story here about what it's like for a girl to start out in show business as a very small child star. She was only 7 when she started on Punky Brewster, and then grow up and try to understand who you are, not just as a person in a different body, but as a performer and a commodity. And there's a segment that gets into her decision to get breast reduction surgery as a teenager and why she decided to go public about it and what she thought it would do for her career and how that did not really turn out. And there's also a story about how these young Hollywood kids being wealthy and powerful and unsupervised and the consequences that had, including on her. And we dip in and out of the people that she knew in their youth who aren't in the movie because there had to be 8 in memoriam cards at the end of the movie for people who were her age. Who died by accident or suicide. And I think there's definitely a more complicated story in whatever went on between the person that she keeps calling the person I lost my virginity to. Like, she's trying to protect his identity, but then it's Charlie Sheen. And, like, she shows a photo of the two of them. Like, based on her own timeline, she says, she's now saying that she, as she's doing interviews about it, that it was when she was 18.
Okay. Having ever known anything about Charlie Sheen, doubt it.
Well, I mean, and even if he was 29 at the time.
Yeah.
So
gross.
Like, yeah. And also, like, she was friends with Corey Feldman at the same time, too. And I forgot until these interviews started happening, like, Corey Feldman has also alleged that Charlie Sheen sexually assaulted him. So it's like, and her answer on that is just like, well, he was nice to me. Like, she just frames it as like, he was my Mr. Big, this like what might have been guy who came in and out of her life in this glamorous way. And, you know, she seems like she hasn't interrogated like what he was getting out of this relationship with her when he was 29 and she was 18. But anyway, the failure to get into that in a more thoughtful way is emblematic of the problem with the movie as a whole, which is that she's the director and does not seem to have, like, the experience or remove or discernment to think more about, like, what got in the final project. Like, there's a ton of this old footage. It's not good footage. It's, like, shot by a young teenager or an older teenager who was drunk or high at a party. And, like, you know, you don't have to put all of it in. It just seems like she remembered she had it and then thought she should do something with it. And then she wasn't sure what. So she went to her husband, who works for Ashton Kutcher's production company, and got her set up. And this was the result. Like, it's not personal enough to work as her biography. It's not broad enough to work as a history of young Hollywood in the 90s. It just feels like sitting around with people you kind of know as they go, remember that time we for an hour or 10, even though you don't because you weren't there. Like, it's meaningful for them. There's not anything in it for you, which is too bad. And I would say between framing Britney Spears, the Harry and Meghan interview, and this, we're definitely coming to a critical mass of like getting regular people to understand fame is bad, like maybe the thing that could kill you. But of the 3 projects, this is the weakest and the least considered. And I wish she had just given this all to a real documentarian, because there could have been a more interesting story about this, but this is not it for me.
Any fridges in this one?
There are no fridges, sadly.
What is with her and just denying her death trap fridge legacy?
Speaking of the 90s, my plug is Listen to Sassy, the podcast about Sassy Magazine, the teen magazine that was super great from 1988 to 1994. Dave and me and our friend Pamela Ribbon going issue by issue through that magazine. You can find it at listentosassy.com and on all of your podcast apps.
This week I learned about tampons.
And how?
Tampons, finally. Who knew? Allison, your turn. What do you got?
Okay, I went with the high and lowbrow framing, and I will start with highbrow. The 4-part HBO docuseries Alan v. Farrow concluded this week, which means you can now really punish yourself and just watch it all in one go.
Don't do that. I'm telling you, don't do that.
No.
I mean, my poor editor, I was like, hey, I'm writing on it this week. And he was like, okay, I'll just catch up over the weekend. And I was like, you should maybe not do that. It's really okay if you haven't seen the whole thing, but.
You need breaks.
Yeah, I mean, for all the reasons we're hinting at, I would hesitate to maybe give it a full-throated recommendation, particularly if you have any kind of experience with childhood trauma, sexual abuse, any of that stuff. But that said, I went into this documentary as someone who both believes Dylan, thinks the whole Sunni dynamic is repellent, and has a really, really strong and long-lasting attachment to Woody Allen's work as a director. Like, I'm Jewish. Most of my family is from New York. I have literally, like, run into Woody Allen around the corner from my grandparents' apartment. Like, it is a very important, like, him and Philip Roth are kind of the devil right. and devil on the shoulder of my inherited cultural identity. But, you know, one of the things I really loved about the documentary's approach is I think it's gotten a lot of attention, rightly so, for a lot of the kind of firsthand documentation it has, because Mia Farrow and Dylan Farrow and Ronan Farrow and a lot of their siblings directly participated in the project. Mm-hmm. They get, I mean, I think the part that's gotten the most attention is that Mia took a lot of contemporary videotapes of Dylan as a child describing what Woody Allen allegedly did to her. And also the directors somehow got their hands on tapes of Woody Allen recording his own phone calls. And there's like a particularly chilling one where he's like, what Mia asks him, are you taping? And he goes, no, I wouldn't even know how to do that. And then you hear him take another call, say, I'll call you back. I'm taping this conversation with Mia, and then goes back.
Yeah.
So that part of it is a lot to watch. But I think the part of it I really liked the most and that I wrote about on The Ringer this week is that it very seriously talks about Woody's work as a director in a way that is neither taking the like, well, because he's a bad person, obviously his work sucks too approach that I think a lot of people find very aggravating, or the like, well, he's such a monster, his work doesn't matter. And I think it goes into it partly to illustrate, you know, why he became so powerful because people like his work so much, but also I think it just treats him very seriously as an artist who is making personal work and therefore examines his work for traces of his personality. And I thought that was really, really smart of the directors, and they treat it exactly right where it doesn't feel like it's overwhelming the rest of the documentary, and it really fits into it. And I just thought it was incredibly well done. And then on a much lighter note, my lowbrow pick was that I wrote a 10-year anniversary piece on Greek, the ABC Yay. Family kind of dramedy, I think you would call it. Like, it's not a sitcom, but it is funny. And it really, like, I just realized on Wikipedia that it was the 10-year anniversary, and I went to my editor, and he was like, yeah, you should definitely try to put something together on that. And it's one of those things where once you start talking to people, you realize both, you know, it's a very beloved show, but also it arrived at this like weird inflection point where like people started watching TV on the internet and like millennials were old enough to start like starring in shows and driving the culture. And obviously it still really endures because to this day, there are so few shows about college. And obviously Freeform has Grown-ish now, which is delightful. And there's Felicity Before Greek. But, you know, looking back, it's kind of wild that it was such a, you know, beloved, successful show about a part of the population that I think a lot of people don't have positive feelings about. And when you go back, I thought one of the things it does best is, you know, it's clearly coming from a place of love and affection and has an insider's perspective on like the social dynamics and how it works. But it's like kind of bitchy and funny in a way that's not that like overt Ryan Murphy camp, but I think like clearly has a little bit of an outsider perspective on the subject. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it, and I will just transition straight into my plug. You can read the piece I wrote about it on The Ringer, which is where you can find all of my work, and also I'm on Twitter at aherman2006, which was my AIM screen name back in the day.
Love it.
Sarah, what do you got?
I would like to thank Danny McEachran, past and I'm sure future guest and friend of the podcast, for having a very funny tweet about being like, oh, I should go outside. And then noticing that Last Chance U basketball had dropped on Netflix and being like, smell you later outside. Because ditto at our house. I have talked about Last Chance U before. It had, I think, 5 previous seasons. It was about JUCO football. And you know, Last Chance U being some of these guys' last chance to get into a D1 program and get out of whatever situation either took them out of a D1 program before this or sort of prevented them from getting on that very narrow and problematic path towards the plantation system of college athletics. Yes, I'm never going to drop that. It's like Chris on Melrose. Where is he? Pay the fucking players. Anyway, they announced that the football version was ending, but they were transitioning into a basketball iteration of the show. I am really enjoying it, not least because I know this sport and D1 hoops way better than I know football generally or D1 football at all. This is also the first time the series has had a head coach of color with a given team. I think showing the white coach black player relationship in the football iteration was instructive, if not cheery, vis-a-vis how that dynamic reinforces other dynamics that are also, shall we say, not neutral when it comes to college sports. The white privilege, the famous original class privilege, jock privilege. Having just watched the Operation Varsity Blues documentary, I'm also reminded that college athletics are often the financial engine that drives college, which is fucked up. And how do we dismantle that while not closing doors of opportunity for young people who don't have another path forward to an education? It's all a big mess. I don't have any answers. You may not want reminding of that fact. And I also have to say my one critique of the series itself is that Greg Whiteley's team, the series is always really well built, but they aren't quite as good at shooting basketball games. Like just from a logistical standpoint, the same slow-mo zoom pan thing that they do that creates tension effectively in a football game, like with a Hail Mary pass, you literally have to frame a basketball game differently so that the important shit like shows up in the frame. You have to settle for a medium shot to get everyone in. I know, you know, film school is trying to hear that, but that's what you have to do. There's a reason there's literally one camera angle for any college basketball game. Get the knack. Yeah. Anyway, it's still very good. They do seem, we're up to episode 5. They do seem to be like learning from dailies, like how they're supposed to be in the gym.
In space.
Basically.
Yeah.
And also I would watch Last Chance U Golf or Last Chance U Tiddlywinks if they made that shit. So it's on Netflix. Enjoy it. It is like sports documentaries for people who don't like sports or documentaries. Well done. Operation Varsity Blues is also very good, and you can read why I think so at Primetimer. But my plug this week is stepping over to a different kind of reality TV analysis. Another past and future guest, Stephanie Early Green, wrote a short story for pointsincase.com called "I Am Your Bachelor and I Am Also Running to Be Your Governor." That's pretty much like it's right there on the tin. I laughed out loud 3 times in the first paragraph. I recommend it, and we will link it in the show notes, especially in the last couple of days. I feel like everyone's feelings about The Bachelor are, with good reason, super, super sour patch. Mm. This is a little bit more coming to it from a place of love and deep familiarity and also frustrated rage because it's the Bachelor franchise and it creates a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
Sadly, no 911 Lone Star report this week
because
911 Lone Star is off the air for a while. TV's greatest show is not with us anymore. How are we going to operate? How are we going to survive this drone? We are trying by watching the original 911. And let me tell you, for every one episode of Lone Star, there is like 5 episodes of 911. It takes them to reach the same level of bonkers. Like 911 operates at such a lower level than 911 Lone Star. Like the Rob Lowe show is such a perfect evolution of that formula. And we thought we like had struck gold again twice because we just skipped to like, we watched the pilot of 911 and then we're like, we watched another one. It's like, this is like once in a while it feels the same, but generally it's like way too focused on the people. We don't care about the people. We want to see like the crazy ass emergencies, you know, like how did this guy's arm end in his eye socket or whatever's going to happen this week. And there's just not enough of that 911. So we skipped to season 2, and the season 2 premiere was like this giant earthquake that happened in LA and all this crazy shit happened. And it was great. It was a great like event episode. And they sort of extended it into the second episode. That was great. And then like, boom, right back to this boring ass shit. Only once in a while did they come up with a good concept. And like, there's three of those in episode sometimes in Lone Star. So I'm just saying, I don't know if 911's going to do it for me. I'm going to give it a few more episodes, but I'm not feeling it. I really don't care about Peter Krause's personal life. Mm. Not interesting.
I mean, no. Evergreen tweet.
I have a friend who worked as a location manager on 911 that I believe trying to finagle like the Santa Monica Pier for the aforementioned earthquake sequence that I think also involves some substitutions with a Mexican beachfront. But it's always funny to hear about, like you said, like none of the people just tell me about how they're staging these insane emergencies.
Yeah.
And so that was the perfect way to experience it.
They are like, they really feel like the thing you say before you have to bring it down to TV level. They're doing that thing they say originally. Like, I don't know, let's have like, you know, the guy, the body fall out of a plane and crash into a, you know, a coffin at a graveside service. Yeah, right. Okay, what are we really going to do? No, let's do that. That's 911 Lone Star. And 911 seems to be like, we got to tone it down. Like, there's something, there's something missing 911. Anyways, when's it coming back, Tara?
Lone Star?
Yeah.
Later in April, I think.
Oh, okay. I thought it was like a month's wait. That's not so bad. I can make it through that.
It's April or May. It's not that long.
Phew. All right. Let me explain to you what's happening soon in the Extra Hot Great Extended Universe on the next EHGG's plural, because we are doing some advanced recording. Next one, it is Recast This, where we try to recast Star Trek The Next Generation. Is The Rock in mine? Yes, he is. And then the next one after that is Making Your Theme Park Mark. One of our Patreon supporters challenged us to create a theme park based on a TV property, explain the rides, what's going on in your theme park. And then after that, we have Tara Makes Everyone Watch the series premiere of Dark Shadows.
Yeah, turns out it was not the series premiere at all. It was just the first episode that Barnabas Collins is in. It's like season one, episode 210, apparently. But okay. Anyway.
Well, we'll change that when the time comes. Yeah. All those plus over 100 more episodes are available to supporters at any level. You can join at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, it's already done. It's already been edited. It is waiting for you next week. It is Muppet Thunderdome with our good friend Adam Grossworth. 27 Muppets enter Muppet Thunderdome. They fight three at a time. We hash out who would win each fight, who would be dead on the floor after each fight, and then ultimately who will be the winner. Will it be the singing fruit? Who's to say? And then on the next one after that, we've got ABC's new dog grooming competition, Pooch Perfect, with our returning guest. It is Andy Daynart from Reality Blurred. Yes. Look forward to that. All that's happening. There's so many things happening. And we're taking some time off because it is Sarah D. Bunting's birthday soon. So happy birthday in advance, Sarah D. Bunting.
Happy birthday,
thank you,
Sarah.
Happy birthday.
Same birthday.
It is time for the canon I'm presenting this week. My argument is going to be short and sweet because season one, episode 5 of Warrior, The Blood and the Shit, is not a complicated episode, but it is a fine episode. It is just a fun and well-crafted bottle episode about a gunfight at a saloon. If you haven't watched Warrior, here is like my minimal background you need to get into it. It's loosely based on Bruce Lee concepts and pitches that he never got off the ground because basically it was like too Asian for the studios. And the show is set in the 1880s. The main character, Assam, arrives in San Francisco, joins one of the Chinese tongs or gangs in town to make ends meet. He connects with Young Jun, the hot-headed son of the elder Tong leader. And Young Jun kind of looks like if he had bigger hair, he'd be a really, really good rockabilly candidate. He's got that face.
Mm-hmm. He does.
Yep, for sure.
And in this episode, which is only the fifth episode of the series, they are transporting a body of a Tong affiliate for shipment back to the homeland, back to China. The last thing you need to know about Warrior going into this episode is that they employ a Hunt for Red October language use policy, which is when Chinese characters are alone together, they are speaking Chinese in real life, but the audience gets English. When in mixed company, they will speak Chinese both in real life and on the show with subtitles. And that Assam and Young Jun both understand English, but Young Jun doesn't speak it. And he's yet to figure out that Assam actually does speak English. So that is a background for Warrior. The episode, which is just like this fun episode, that's the basis of my argument. It's just a fun bottle episode. The show does have some things to say about race relations, how they mirror what's going on today. And certainly this episode has some of that. But really, it's just a really good bottle episode about a gunfight. So the episode goes like this. Assam and Young Jun are far from San Francisco. They're riding in a stagecoach as the episode starts. Inside the stagecoach with them is a snooty, rich, racist couple, a grizzled, racist asshole, and an Irish priest who, relative to all the other people, is less racist. All these people are what the Chinese would call ducks in the show because they're white, and ducks live in their neighborhoods, which are called ponds. So some glossary terms for you from the show, which is fantastic, by the way.
Yes.
And then the Chinese sometimes refer to themselves as onions because there are so many Chinese people in San Francisco that everybody thinks they have the worth of an onion. So that's why sometimes you'll hear them described as onions. Everyone in the stagecoach is talking about this pair, but not to them because they assume they do not speak or understand English. The coach driver stops at this lonely saloon. It's literally in the middle of nowhere. You see shots of it. There's like nothing else around. There's a mountain, there's fields, and there's like three buildings. This place has one barkeep, one cook, and two whores. We spend a little time with everybody in the place. The cook, Lou, is from China and bonds with our guys when he brings them some drunken chicken because it's all ham and beans until San Francisco, according to him. The grizzled asshole we met on the stagecoach won't fuck the Native American whore and thinks ham and beans sound great. The snooty couple be snootin'. Everybody just seems to be who you think they are on the surface. However, Assam learns the cook isn't just the cook, as we'll hear in clip one.
Something wrong?
We almost never get any Chinese in here, so it's been a while since I heard some white bastard talk down to us. I should have thrown him right the fuck out of here. You don't come to my place and talk that kind of shit.
Your place? Aren't you the cook?
I am the cook. But I also built it. Cut down and planed every piece of wood you see in here.
How does a guy from Ubay end up owning a saloon in Nevada?
I've done it all. 10 years on the railroad, laying down track, growing food for them. After that, 5 years of squeezing gold out of a mining claim the duck said was dry. I quit, and I came here when they wouldn't give me the going rate for my gold. Twice the work for half the pay. I couldn't live with that anymore.
And they also discover the barkeep, a white woman, isn't his employer after all.
Like you and her.
That little lady right there? She is my gold mountain. That's America, little brother. Plenty of opportunity, just never where you think.
Now back with the rest of the people, Grizzly Man, as I decided to call him, decides to pick a fight with Young Jun. And when he pulls a pistol on him, he receives a cheek-to-cheek rifle shot from the saloon entrance where a no-good posse of outlaws have arrived to enrich themselves at everybody's expense. After the empty tills and wallets, the posse leader wants them to open up the coffin that our duo has been transporting. At this point, a glorious burst of violence of guns and axes and knives occurs in which all the outlaws save the leader are dispatched. He's going to be back tonight with more guns and more men. Why the coffin, though? It seems like there's Tong gold in the coffin going back to the mainland, unbeknownst to Assam and Young Jun. Actually, there's gold in the corpse in the coffin, which we discover after some quick and gushy frontier surgery. So the end game is set up, an inescapable gunfight at the saloon in the middle of nowhere in a couple hours. Nowhere to run to, nowhere to hide. But Mr. Snooty has a thought. This is where the, oh my God, he speaks English beat is happening. And when you hear the incredulous Chinese dialogue, that is young June staring at Awesome saying, what the fuck?
We're going to have to fight.
We can't fight a bunch of outlaws. The father is right. We may not be able to survive a night out there, but we can take our chances in a few hours. We leave the gold here for them and we find a place to hide until they've come and gone. If I were Mr. French, I'd consider the night a success and not waste my time hunting down a group of strangers. It's our best chance.
That would be a great plan if it were your gold. But it's not. So it isn't.
You lail old me.
Lord have mercy.
You speak English.
So Mr. Snooty has other ideas. Maybe leave the gold and hope they don't follow?
Listen, that gold is the reason we're in this mess. And it's our way out. As far as I'm concerned, there's nothing left to discuss.
I guess it's settled then.
Damn right it's settled.
So all you gotta do is come over here and take it from me.
So they can't leave. Maybe just hope for the best. No. Nothing's going to happen. Lou has just pulled a shotgun. He doesn't want to go anywhere. He wants to stay and protect what is his. So everybody else is going to do the same. He's got something to fight for. And eventually he appeals to everybody's better angels to help out. It's time to fight together. The last one quarter of the episode is just one big saloon fight that starts with this negotiation showdown between Awesome and the returned posse leader. This is the last bit of that confrontation.
Just as soon as you let the rest of us ride off in some of your horses.
Nah, I could agree to that. But we both know that would be a lie, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
Then why even ask?
This is a negotiation. That was my opening bit.
Negotiation. you hear that, boys? This is no fucking negotiation. See, in order to negotiate, you need to have yourself some leverage.
But I do.
Yeah? What's that?
If you leave now, I won't kill you.
Awesome just like snap grabs this dude neck and rips out his fucking throat in like 1 second. It is fucking amazing. And that is accompanied by the soundtrack you just heard. And that soundtrack is never shy on Warrior, and the electric guitars kind of add that modern punch to the proceedings. The fight scenes in Warrior are like always kinetic and crunchy, and this hybrid sort of guns, martial arts, John Wickian fight is no exception. There's lots of little great moments in the fight, but I will say it just ends on a rimshot chandelier drop. So, you know, it's fun. It's got a chandelier dropping at the end of the fight. It's not trying to be too serious. After the fight, everybody says their thank yous. Awesome and Young June ride into the sunset because they did it. They cured racism. Yay. To paraphrase John Waters from The Simpsons. Now, if every white person in America could be saved by a gunfight by a couple of Chinese guys, we'd be all set. The episode ends with them riding into the sunset cheekily, with complete with the end and all that. In conclusion, The Blood and the Shit is a fun action bottle episode that takes Warrior on an early satisfying trip outside of San Francisco settings. It is not a complicated argument. I just really enjoyed this episode for setting up a great action scene and sort of being a fun journey until we get to that sort of last third, last quarter of the episode. So that is basically my argument. Who wants to start us off with reactions?
Allison picked this from our list of submissions. So Allison, why don't you start?
Sure. Well, first, Dave, I would like to thank you for picking this because it reminded me what a delightful show Warrior is, and also that I kind of forgot that a second season of it came out, as often happens. Yeah. And that entire second season, in addition to the first, is available to stream on HBO Max, which is great because it originally aired on Cinemax, and most people I know don't have that. But I will add my perspective as a woman who is attracted to men and say that the lead of Warrior, Andrew Koji, is extremely attractive. There are lots of other extremely attractive people in the show. There's a lot of shirtlessness as well. Yep. And there is an, at best, tenuous relationship to period detail that means that they all have, like, very fashionable 2020s, like, fades in terms of their haircuts. And as you heard in the clips, the awesome, you know, the idea in the show is that he's a quarter American and he learned English from his, I think, supposed to be white grandfather.
Yeah.
But he grew up in China, and yet this language that he learned from one other person, he speaks completely unaccented, which is incredible. But it just adds up to a show that is very silly and knows that it is there to deliver fight sequences in the spirit of Bruce Lee. And it just does that really well. It doesn't take itself very seriously in the story, but it clearly takes itself very seriously in how it stages set pieces. And The Blood and the Shit is such a great selection because it is one giant set piece, and it includes, you know, there's a whole, I don't even think we got to the little running subplot where young June, like, falls in love with a hooker that he can't even talk to. But it manages to weave that kind of storytelling in, even though very obviously the entire episode is leading up to the point where Awesome rips someone's throat out. And I also think that happens, like, literally 20 seconds into the new season. Like, that's just been added to the repertoire of stuff that happens on the show. But I really enjoy this episode.
Sure.
Exactly.
Sarah, why don't you go next?
I don't have a lot to add. I had not been watching the show, but as listeners know, one of my criteria for canon selection is would I keep watching this? And I definitely wanted to click over to the next episode. So check that box. I love the Hunt for Red October workaround of languages and subtitles. I don't know why every single series with this in play, this multilingual situation in play doesn't just do that. Like, you know, I mean, nobody really thought back in the 20th century that all Nazis had British accents, but like this was the sort of collectively agreed upon solution for that. Why can't we just do this? There is a wish fulfillment aspect of this that reminded me of recent Tarantino product in that, like, you know, you're sort of being manipulated to side with the story because this is what everybody wanted to happen instead of what, like, really quote unquote happened in life. But it's done so well, that you don't care, that you don't mind that you're being sort of like sucked up to a little bit. Like, Inglourious Basterds is one example. Actually, really any recent, like any Tarantino of the last 10 or 15 years is sort of recasting this history as a triumph of the victim.
I will say, though, to that point, that Warrior, the people that like succeed in Warrior, they're all criminals. And the general population in Chinatown really having a shitty time.
Yeah, they're not doing great.
And there's actually like a big labor crisis storyline that runs through the first and second seasons that's all about that. So it's not a story of prosperity. It's a story of this is what you actually have to do to survive this time as a Chinese person in San Francisco.
Right.
These two that you're seeing in this one episode have their in on not dying hungry.
Right.
But then this is satisfying then for the regular viewer because you're seeing this, like, you know, triumph over racism.
Oh, it absolutely has Tarantino vibes to it. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I also enjoy that there's that twist on like this sort of pre-fight dialogue in like old school, like grimy kung fu tends to go on a really long time. And then you have the sort of traditional, like all the, you know, fighters line up to like let Sammy Hung kick their asses. This is like a twist on that. It's a little faster. It's a little more knowing about it. And the final thing that I liked is that this is not desexualizing Asian characters the way that so much of the culture and kung fu movies, which, like, okay, if they're supposed to be Shaolin monks, fine, I get it. But like every now and then, how about a 3D complete as to desire character who likes to fuck and also can fight. It's not the end of the world. Don't make me watch Sonny Chiba movies to get that. They're boring. And this has much more of a complete feeling about these characters that, like, they're not just fighting. So I really thought it was compelling. It was fun to watch. It was satisfying. I wanted to keep watching it. And I think I will keep watching it on my upcoming birthday week off. Woo-hoo. Tara.
I will add, I mean, I'm so glad that both of the women who like men noted the sexiness of our leads, because it is very important that it, you know, has these hot Asian men. It puts them in sexiest situations and makes them super sexy, because thank you.
What is the term for, like, how would you describe Assam as, like, his appearance? Like, he's like wire muscle or something. Like, he's a good Bruce Lee replacement.
Yeah, he's not.
I would think he's.
Go ahead.
He's skinny ripped.
Thank you.
He's like, ripped. You can see the abs on the abs on the abs, but he's also like a very
and
slender
occasionally
person.
A vein. Yeah, totally.
Yes.
Yeah, he's not bulky.
No, no. I I'm glad that Dave clipped it. Not that we can, most of us understand what he's saying, but the moment that young June realizes Assam has been hiding his knowledge of English all this time is such a great reveal. It's so funny. But I'm surprised that Dave didn't lean more on, like, what this episode is as just like an homage to Westerns, because that's not what the rest of the show really is. It's very much like a city show, you know, set in San Francisco specifically, and, you know, in Chinatown.
Yeah, a little more Deadwood-y.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So the way that it follows the beats of, like, a classic, you know, the gunfighters coming into town, except they're not necessarily gunfighters. They're like fist fighters and axe fighters. And
it's like when we leave Austin for somewhere else in Texas and we're like 10 minutes out of town and suddenly you're in a Western. It's the same thing on this show.
Yeah. And how we're called upon to, like, defend a stranger's saloon.
Yeah. Yeah. When we were at that restaurant in Elgin.
Yeah, complaining about that last week. Yeah. What a hassle.
So, yeah, it's adorable, including that, you know, young June falling in love with the sex worker at the saloon. I mean, all of it is just it's a very pitch perfect homage to classic Western tropes.
I just wanted to note, I call them whores because I was just channeling
called.
Yes, of course.
I know that's not what you feel.
And I tried to split the difference and said hooker, which sure. I apologize
Thanks, Allison.
For.
But and the fact that they, as Dave said, you know, with the end at the end of the episode and them, you know, riding off into the sunset with their cowboy hats on, like, it's adorable. Mm-hmm. This is a very good standalone episode for all the reasons that Dave said. And I loved it. It was fun to revisit it. And I'm glad that it has converted Sarah, because I really think this is a show that you will like.
There's another episode in the second season that is sort of similar to this. Yeah. It's not quite as good, but it's basically the Warrior meets the Tekken video game franchise where they go into Mexico and there's just like a giant, hey, everybody, bring your best fighters. We're going to have a tournament. And that's like the whole episode. It's just fight after fight.
Someone brings a bear. Okay.
Yeah, basically. It's like each fighter has like this super distinct personality and like weapon choices. It's like a video game on the screen via Warrior. It's fun too. But this one, I thought I enjoyed a little bit more because it was more contained, less characters. But also it's like the show's fifth episode to actually do like a bottle episode that takes so much of what is a new show and like dispenses with this setting, dispenses with what has been the conflict so far between white labor wants and, you know, the well-being of everybody, and taking all that and sort of saying, putting it on pause and saying, and now a Western Salou fight is like kind of ballsy in a way that I enjoyed.
Yeah. And one more thing before we vote. The other thing that makes this episode very special and better than many episodes in season one is that Assam's dumb blonde duck girlfriend is not in it. I do not like that character. She's absent from the proceedings.
Totally the Pierce of Warrior. Take her out and the show probably gets better for
her. Yeah, get rid of her.
Yep. All right, let's put this to the official vote. Allison, do you say this episode is canon worthy or not?
Aye. Do we do aye or nay? I say yes.
Yeah. All right. Sarah D. Bunting?
Aye.
Tara Ariano?
Aye for me as well.
Yay. right, that means Warrior Season 1, Episode 5, The Blood and the Shit. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
The winner this week is a very British scandal, which I didn't even know was getting a season two, but it is. And Paul Bettany and Claire Foy will be headlining it as the Duke and Duchess of Argyll. Don't know. Don't at me. Actually, do at me. I'd like to know. But their divorce in the early 60s was quite celebrated, according to my online sources, namely Wikipedia, featuring salacious photographs and scandalous stories. I don't know what any of them are, but I am thrilled to see what Bettany and Foy do with them.
Loser this week, Chris Harrison, officially out as host of the next season of The Bachelorette. Maybe forever. Who's to say? Tayshia Adams and Caitlin Bristow, past Bachelorettes, are going to be hosting instead. And we also found out they're going to be doing two seasons of The Bachelorette in 2021. I forget who tweeted it, but someone was like, after Chris Harrison's just showing his whole ass defending the ultimate winner of The Bachelor, although they didn't end up staying together. the franchise was like, you know what? We're done with men for a while. Just get rid of Chris, get rid of all men. Goodbye. And also, yeah, everyone is mad about the way this season of The Bachelor ended. I do not watch it, but it sounds like a complete shit show all around.
Yeah.
And speaking of people who are not doing their normal jobs.
Speaking of a complete shit shows all around.
Yeah, really. Come on.
Do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
It's Brand Regulation game time. We are between game time seasons, which means we're doing a non-regulation game time so that David T. Cole can also play.
Thank you.
This game is called Camera Shy. This is a game about TV characters who, as the title suggests, are not seen by the audience. But that can mean a lot of different things. Sometimes we see parts of their body, but not their face. Sometimes we only hear their voice. Sometimes they exist only as a presence that looms over the lives of other characters on the show, but we don't actually see or hear them directly at all. We just hear about them. So I will give you the name of a camera shy character. You can tell me the show they're from. Based on that alone, you will get 2 points. If you need a hint, I will tell you the name of a character who would have talked to or about them. Then it's worth 1 point. Most shows are only in here once, but there is one show that is in here 3 times. There's also a character who did not appear in the original version of their series, but did show up when that show got a sequel series many series later. Many years later. So don't at me. I know. There are 27 characters. And a tiebreaker. We will be playing for 3 steel meals for yourself and 1 that you may gift to another player at your discretion. Ooh. And since Dave wins and then gets steel meals and never gets to use them, steel meals will be in play today. Let us go to Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. So our order will be Sarah, then Allison, then Dave. Are we ready to play Camera Shy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Sarah D. Bunting. Your character is Wilson.
Home Improvement.
That is correct for 2 points. Allison. Your character is Heather Sinclair.
Oh my God. I'm going to eat shit at this. I'm so sorry.
You can ask for a hint.
All right. Hint.
Paige Michaelchuk.
Someone is going to steal this from me. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Anyone?
I mean, I know it, but I'm not burning steel meals at non-regulation.
What is it, Sarah?
It is Degrassi, The Next Generation.
That is correct.
Big blind spot.
All right, David T. Cole.
Yeah.
Your character.
Uh-huh.
Cousin Jeffrey.
Damn it. Cousin Jeffrey. Cousin Jeffrey. Okay, yep. Cousin Oliver was the Brady Bunch, but he was seen. So somebody's not seen. Somebody's not seen. I'm going to need the hint.
Your hint is Uncle Leo.
Oh, Seinfeld?
Seinfeld is correct.
Cousin Jeffrey. Oh, yeah, right. Cousin Jeffrey.
Yeah.
I thought we saw him. All right.
Nope. George thinks he sees him, but it's a horse. He has his glasses off, but he's squinting.
Amazing.
All right. Sarah, Charlie Townsend.
Hint.
Jill Monroe.
Jill Monroe. Don't know. Someone should steal meal.
Anyone? Charlie's Angels.
Oh, Jill Monroe, yeah, right. Of course.
All right.
I'm feeling less bad now that everyone here has missed one or needed a hint.
Sarah just came strong out of the gate, but now we're all flailing
around. Yeah.
Allison, your next unseen character is Nanny.
Nanny. Hint?
Kermit.
Oh, the Muppets.
Wait. Steel Mill.
Yes, Dave?
Muppet Babies.
Muppet Babies is correct.
Oh. See, and on the day we talk about the puppet show, too.
All right, back to Dave. Your character is Dr. Claw.
That is Inspector Gadget.
Inspector Gadget is correct.
Nice.
You get one Tara point for you doing the voice.
Thanks. I was wondering if the guy has to do the voice like I just did the voice, where if I did it for three more seconds, my throat would fall out like that
guy
from
Warrior.
Yeah, you
get a polyp. Totally.
Because it hurt. It hurt doing that.
All right. Back to Sarah. Her character is Bob Sacamano.
Sacamano?
Mm-hmm. Bob. First name Bob.
Bob Sacamano. Hint, please.
Cosmo Kramer.
Oh, that's Seinfeld again.
I guess we know what we have one more of in the show.
Back to Allison. Your character is Stanley Walker.
Stanley Walker. Hint?
Will Truman.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Not the Truman Show, is a movie.
How long are we doing this? Are we getting her a grace period for the answer?
Not Seinfeld again. All right, I have a no.
Okay.
I'm a no. I don't have it.
Okay. Dave?
Not even with a sly hint about grace periods?
Correct answer is Will and Grace.
All right, back to Dave. I don't know Will's last name. I just realized that.
It's Truman.
You do now.
Okay.
Carry this into your next trivia opportunity. All right, Dave.
Yeah.
Your character is the banker.
Oh, Deal or No Deal?
Deal or No Deal is correct.
Nice. Good job, Dave.
Sarah. Your character is Carlton the Doorman.
Jeffersons.
Oh, this ring. Can we get the hint? Just for chasing Google?
For fun? Sure. Rhoda Morgenstern.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought it was.
Okay.
Okay.
So, wait, is that Rhoda or Mary Tyler Moore Show?
It's Rhoda.
Okay, yeah.
Back to Allison. Your character is the little red-haired girl.
Oh, I do think I know this, but I need a hint.
Lucy Van Pelt.
Okay, Peanuts.
Peanuts is correct for 1 point.
Woo!
Yay!
Back to Dave.
Yep.
Your character is President Stuart Hughes.
Oh, man. That could be anything. Stuart Hughes.
Allison knows.
Well, I mean, when it comes to president, well, no, I think all the presidents on 24 were seen. Probably abducted. Probably chopped up or something, too. I'm going to need the hint.
Your hint is Selena Meyer.
Oh, Veep.
Veep is correct for 1 point. Let's get a score break.
Score break.
Allison is on the board with 1 point. I came out strong and fell on my face and have 3 points. Dave is well in the lead with 7 points.
Whoa. Still lots of game to go. Let's get back into it. Sarah D. Bunting, your next character is Orson.
Oh,
I'm going to be mad, but hint?
Mork.
Yeah.
Mork and Mindy.
Mork and Mindy is correct for 1 point.
How did you figure that one out?
I don't know.
I mean, some of those easier than others. Okay. Allison. Dr. Mm-hmm. Richard Nygaard.
Oh my God. Okay. I know the name, but I need the hint.
Chris Traeger.
Oh, Parks and Recreation.
Parks and Recreation is correct for 1 point. Back to Dave. Your unseen character is Corona.
Corona.
This is a person.
Character named Corona.
Mm-hmm.
Corona. Sounds like maybe a stripper.
My Corona.
Hint, please.
Cheyenne.
Oh, superstar?
Yes.
What was her Corona?
It's her friend that she talks about all
right,
the time.
Oh, yeah, right. Yep.
I was going to make a dumb joke about how Corona's an unseen character in all of our lives right now. But
I was thinking it.
Yeah. All right, back to Sarah. I feel good about your chances with this one. Vera Peterson.
Cheers.
Cheers is correct for 2 points. Allison, your character is Diane.
Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks is correct.
I was waiting for it ever since you said that they're unseen, but they're seen in the reboot. So glad I got to jump on that.
All right, Dave.
Yeah.
Your unseen character, Trudy Beekman.
Trudy Beekman. Trudy. Trudy Beekman. Hint, please.
Mallory Archer.
Trudy Beekman. Oh, yeah. Rivaled Trudy Beekman across the hallway from Mallory from Archer.
Archer is correct for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting, once again, picky smiles on you. The one you've been waiting for, probably. Tino.
Him and the Chase's cat. That would be My So-Called Life.
My So-Called Life is correct for 2 points. Allison, Miss Sarah Bellum. S-A-R-A space B-E-L-L-U-M.
Sarah Bellum. Okay, sounds like a kid's show. Hint?
Buttercup.
Oh, Powerpuff Girls?
Powerpuff Girls is correct.
Aw.
Dave.
Yep.
Ugly Naked Guy.
Friends.
Friends is correct for 2 points.
Softball. Softballs.
Well, Mr. Shot.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Shots?
Mr. Shots, S-H-O-T-Z, or Z.
Hint.
Laverne DeFazio.
Oh, Laverne and Shirley.
Yes, it's our boss, who I guess is only ever on the speaker.
Okay.
This is for Allison, George Steinbrenner.
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld's correct.
Go.
There's the last one. And for Dave.
Yeah.
Maris Crane.
Oh, I was like upset. I'm not going to say what I was thinking because that was really dumb. That is Frasier, and I ought to know.
Oh,
I'm Frasier.
That is correct. All right. You each have one question left. Let's get another score break.
Allison closing the gap with 7. I have 9. Dave comfortably in the lead still with lucky 13 points.
Oh, boy. All right. Here we go. Dave.
Yes.
No, wait. Sorry. No. Sarah. Sarah. Huh?
What?
Sarah.
The parrot.
Mrs. Wolowitz.
Hint.
Sheldon Cooper.
Cooper. Big Bang Theory?
Correct. For 1 point.
Neat.
I was going to say 50-50 chance there.
Would have been great if it were young Sheldon.
Yeah.
Would it?
Very weird flash forward. Okay, Allison, your final question. Lola Montez.
Oh, Dickinson.
Correct for 2 points.
Nice.
Great season.
It was. Dave, your last question. Epstein's mother.
Epstein's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I've already got the points. I'll just roll the bones. The only Epstein I know is Welcome Back, Carter. Cotter.
That is correct for 2 points.
Nicely done, Dave.
Let's get the final scores.
Allison finishing strong with 9. I was just ahead of her with 10. And our champion, David T. Cole, with 15.
Yay.
Good job, Dave.
All right, Dave, how do you want to allocate your one extra point?
One steel meal, you mean?
You have one. Yes, sorry. Your one steel meal to gift to another player.
I am going to gift it to whoever is behind at the next score break of the next game.
Okay.
Okay.
It's a dynamic gift.
That'll probably be me.
Yay!
You're welcome!
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, we also have a tiebreaker, so let's have Dave sit out, and this one will just be for Allison and Sarah. Robin Masters.
Come on, Sarah. Oh, my God. Oh, my mouth.
Are we allowed to, like, mutually Dave. Ask for the hint?
Sure.
Oh, I think I just get it now. Wait, can I give the hint?
Sure.
I mean, I know it, but I just wanted this to go on for a while.
Right, great performance.
In the ocean. Now I'm looking at this lady's bum.
It's Magnum.
Yes, it is. Good job, everybody.
Yay. Good game, Tara.
Dave.
Thanks for the game, Tara.
You're welcome.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We sampled Waffle and Mochi from Netflix before going around the dial with stops at Step Up High Water, Kid 90, Alan V. Farrow, Greek, and Last Chance U, Basketball. Dave got the blood and the shit into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And me, Dave, was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Next up, it's recasting The Next Generation, designing TV theme parks, and a Dark Shadows foresending of the next three extra, extra hot greats. And on the next EHG Prime, Muppet Thunderdome, followed by Pooch Perfect. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
gotta go do my spider dance.
Sarah D. Bunting.
All this food is made of food.
And Allison Herman.
First time guest, last in the game.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
The first time in your lives, I think you've actually done something well.
That's really nice.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.